All right, folks, welcome back to Hour 2 of the Joe Mangiacotti Show. I'm Joe Mangiacotti from the Clinton Savings Bank Studios. Don't forget to follow us on our social media platforms at Joe Mangi Show. 508-871-7000 to join the conversation. And our text line is 617-297-8388. 617-297-8388. If you can't text but you have the device, if you just email us at textjoeintheradio@gmail.com, it will show up on the same screen. So you got it that way. All right, folks. So we have a lot to talk about still. I know the show's going very fast today, Shane,
it's
right?
Flying by.
Flying right by, which is fantastic. And thanks for all the calls at 508-871-7000. So tomorrow is December 1st. And like I was saying in hour one, it's the anniversary of the launch of Civil Air Patrol, United States Air Force Auxiliary, Colonel Keith Raymond from Massachusetts Wing. He's the commander for the state, will join us in studio in hour two tomorrow. And, of course, December 7th is coming up next week, which launched us into World War II. And joining us is now, let me invite you into the conversation, Steve Schneider, who is a World War II expert and also the author of Shot Down. Now, what's interesting here is, first of all, it's an Amazon number one bestseller. He's also the recipient of more than 25 national book awards. And Shot Down is set within the framework of World War II in Europe, and it recounts the dramatic experiences of each member of a 10-man team, the B-17 bomber crew, after the plane piloted by author Steve Schneider's dad. So it's his dad who was the captain on the plane. He was knocked out of the sky by a German fighter over the French-Belgium border on February 8th, 1944. Now, some of the men did die, and some were captured and became prisoners of war, and some men did evade capture. And they were missing in action for months before making it back to England. And their individual stories and those of the courageous Belgian people who risked their lives to help them all are different and all are remarkable. And so let me welcome into the conversation Steve Schneider. Steve, good morning, sir.
Well, thank you, Joe. It's nice to be here.
I got to tell you, first, I thank you so much because I know you're on the West Coast. You're in California, right? You're up very early. Your wife must think you're just crazy. But we appreciate it. Let me say that. I really do. I know it's early for you, sir. Thank you for getting up so early.
My pleasure. No problem.
So, first of all, we're going to talk about the book a little bit, but you're pretty much considered a World War II expert.
Well, more so with the 8th Air Force and the air war over Europe. Mm-hmm. I know a lot about World War II, but particularly the air war over Europe is my area that I'm most interested in.
So the thing here, now your dad, and I thank you for sending the audiobook. It's 8 hours and 21 minutes worth of audio, so I haven't got through it all. But it's interesting because it wasn't really till, I mean, as a kid, you were very much like a lot of us as kids, you know, and you grew up in the 50s. So this was a time where, you know, World War II is very fresh, and you and your buddies really got into playing soldier and so forth. But it wasn't till later in life, really, that you started to kind of, you know, connect, because your dad didn't really talk about things till a little later. Was it when he first visited Belgium?
Yes. Like most World War II veterans, he didn't talk much about the war until a memorial was erected to him and his crew in the little village of Mackinac, Belgium, where the plane came down. That was 1989, and he and the other three crew members that were still living at the time went over for the dedication. And there my dad was reunited with all these Belgian people that hid him from the Germans during the war and visited these homes and farms where he was where he stayed.
Which was extremely dangerous to do. I mean, they absolutely put their lives on the line.
Oh, absolutely. They not only risked their lives, but those of their family and friends to aid downed airmen. If the German secret police found out about it, the Gestapo, they would be arrested, tortured, and either sent to concentration camps or executed. And some of the people who helped my dad and other members of his crew did meet that fate.
Wow. That's very heavy. Yeah.
Yeah. They saved my dad's life. My dad said that, I mean, he just couldn't thank him enough. They would let him sleep in their bed. They'd sleep on the floor. They'd give him the, you know, largest portion of food. You know, with rationing back then, you know, everything was scarce. Right. So they were wonderful people.
But these people looked at your dad and any American serviceman as their saviors at that point. I mean, they had, if it wasn't for the American intervention and then the Allied forces, they didn't stand a chance.
That's correct. And when you talk to Belgian people today, I've been to Belgium 6 times now and made a lot of wonderful friends there. And I remember one guy I was talking to, he goes, why wouldn't we help them? I mean, mm-hmm. they were risking their lives to come save us from Nazi oppression. Mm-hmm. So you know, they felt it was their duty and really their honor to help these U.S. Servicemen.
Yeah. Steve, but let's talk a little bit about the book because, again, thank you for sending the audiobook. I'm making my way through it. I love everything I've heard so far. So, you know, this happened towards the end of the war, and you were able to even speak with the German Luftwaffe pilot who shot down, and it was called, your father named the plane Susan Ruth after your sister.
Right, my oldest sister, okay. who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas.
Wow, that's fantastic. So what was his rank? Was it colonel, captain? What was he at the time?
Well, at the time he was shot down, he was a first lieutenant. Mm-hmm. He was promoted later to captain, but when he was shot down, he was a first lieutenant.
Okay, and so he had the naming rights to the bird, though.
Yeah, if you're the first pilot, the lead pilot, you're the commander of the crew and the plane, and had the last say on what it was named. There were only 3 of the 10 crew members that were married, and he was the only crew member that had a child. So
it went along with that. Now, the thing about it, and I appreciate the audiobook, the only thing I'm missing out on are the pictures. And I'm going yesterday I clicked to order the book because I want to see the pictures. I want to see the pictures.
Yeah.
I love all those.
That makes a difference.
Yeah. I just love looking at those World War II vintage airplanes, and they always had they'd paint the lady on it and the name on it. And in this thing, they called it the Flying Fortress. And it really was. And it was the, you've got this massive machine in the air, which has, you know, for that time, technology was something, you know, it was considered a cutting edge for those days. I mean, let's not forget and put into perspective that prior to entering World War II, United States aviation was behind the rest of the world, major Germany for one. And it's amazing how fast American aviation caught up to and even surpassed in some cases other nations. But it took a lot of people like Billy Mitchell and Goddard and all these great aviators back then to really, you know, draw the fact of the air superiority, right? I mean, up until then, the Navy was considered, and it still is, extremely important. But you've got these guys who would drop, you know, a bag of flour on a munitions building to point out just how superior air forces could be. So it was amazing how quickly we caught up in aviation. Would you say that's accurate?
Oh, absolutely. Not only in aviation, but before the war started, the U.S. ranked 18th in the world in military strength behind Romania. So our armed forces were really behind all the other, you know, so many other countries, like you said, and they geared up so fast. It was just a total united effort by the country.
Yeah. We came a long way, baby. I mean, you know, you look at the military that we have today compared to the rest of the world, right? I mean, it is, but World War II, up until that point, it was hard to convince the nation that we needed this. I mean,
no one wanted to go to war.
Nobody wanted to go to war. Nobody wanted to spend that money. They saw no reason for it. The world was a smaller place then, Steve, would you say? I mean, it was a big deal to cross the ocean. People were still doing it by boat. I mean, the mentality was so different, but like a certain Japanese admiral said, you know, we woke a sleeping giant.
Absolutely.
And mobilized this country like nothing ever has before. But the fact is that you've got this B-17 flying with 10 men on it, and they called it the Flying Fortress. It had incredible firepower. And they're hit. And can you describe a little bit about that day in February of 1944?
Sure. They were on a mission to Frankfurt, Germany, and they dropped their bombs successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by anti-aircraft fire, FLAC, they called it. FLAC was the abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon. And they couldn't get the doors back up, and as a result, they fell behind. They lost airspeed, and they fell behind the formation, or the planes trying to head back to England for their bases. And they were singled out by two Focke-Wulf German fighters, and like wolves or lions coming on prey, they came down and attacked the Susan Ruth. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Two of the crew members were killed in the plane. The other eight bailed out. But both those German fighters were shot down. I didn't learn this out until later, because growing up, all I knew and all my dad knew was that there was attacked by two German fighters, and that was it. But then through my research, I found out that there were two German fighters. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick, and his plane crashed, and he was killed. And the other pilot was Hans Berger. And actually, the gunners on my dad's plane shot Hans Berger down at the same time. So they shot each other down. But Hans was able to bail out of the plane, and he made it through the war. And then I found him later and interviewed him for the book. And I've been to Munich, Germany, where he lives. And so we've developed a friendship. In fact, I just saw him a couple months ago. He turned 96 years old, and we've become friends. So that was quite unique and quite exciting.
The man who shot your father down in World War II, and you were friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, incredible. Incredible story. There is some of the audio from it. Can I play a clip from the book?
Sure.
I want to get there. Shane, why don't you play that clip? And it's towards the end of the clip here when they're bailing out.
I hardly stand it, and I pulled my scarf over the exposed skin. My nose, cheeks, eyebrows, eyelids, and lower forehead must have been burned when I was using the extinguisher. I don't recall any pain from my face until I was on the ground. It was impossible to go back through the fire to see if they had jumped from the rear of the ship, and as I couldn't get any response from anyone, I left the cockpit. As I crawled down to the escape hatch, I was surprised to see Benny and Dan still in the nose. As I made my way toward them, Benny looked down and saw me. I motioned for him to come. He hit Dan on the arm, and they both dived toward their chutes. We went out through the nose hatch. When I jumped, our bomb bay doors were still open. As I crawled through the escape hatch, I recalled the discussion we had about clearing them when jumping, and I wondered if I would.
Wow. And that was the that from your father's perspective? That would be your father saying this.
Yes. While he was missing in action and being hidden, he wrote a diary about his plane being shot down, which is absolutely riveting.
Yeah.
Which is in the book, and that those are his words, right?
Wow. And that was part of the problem, see, right? That the bomb bay doors were open and they couldn't close them, which presents
right.
a problem. It's almost as bad as having landing gear that won't lock as far as trying to, there goes your landing.
Yeah, because it causes a drag on the plane. And but that to be safe, you needed to have those bombers needed to be in a tight formation because if you lag behind or you're a straggler, you were easy pickings for those German fighters.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's very powerful. And like I said, those are his words that he's talking about. They're hit. It's on fire. He has no accountability of where his entire crew is at that point. He doesn't know that two of them died on the ship.
No.
And Benny, now who's Benny to him? Who was Benny? What was his job? And where what was his role in this?
That was his full name was Robert Benninger. And
he, got it.
You know, nickname was Benny. He was the navigator.
So
George Ike was the co-pilot. And then, the bombardier was Richard Daniels, Danny.
Yeah. Right. So two of them died on the plane. The other eight, how many of them became prisoners of war?
Three of those eight became prisoners of war.
So the other five, including your dad, made it to England eventually?
No. My dad and another member of the crew, the tail gunner, they both were able to evade capture. They were missing in action for 7 months. But they had quite different experiences. Bill Schlenker, the tail gunner, he stayed with one location the entire 7 months. He stayed with Josephine Collette and her two daughters, whereas my dad was moved from place to place to place. He might stay one night. He might stay stay 6 weeks at a home. It all depended on how brave the Belgian people were who lived there mm-hmm. and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. But he moved around from place to place, and finally he got tired of hiding. So he ended up joining the French resistance and started sabotaging German convoys.
Wow.
So he had a talk about a dangerous and courageous thing to do. That was, I don't know if many people, I don't know if I could do that, but he wanted to get back into the fight. Sure. So his experiences were quite a bit different than Slinker's. And then the other three men that were able to bail out, they were, they evaded capture for a couple months, and they eventually hooked up with five other downed U.S. airmen from three other B-17s, and they were hiding in the woods in a little shack called a hut, makeshift hut. And unfortunately, a Belgian collaborator told the Germans about them, and the Germans came and captured them, interrogated, and shot all eight of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, this now, as a little kid, you knew nothing of this. It wasn't until later that your dad talked about it. And
yeah, growing up, I knew that my dad was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England, and his plane was named the Susan Ruth. He flew bombing missions over Europe, and he was shot down and missing in action and evaded capture and got back to the U.S. But that was kind of pretty much it growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got older, I learned, you know, more details. And,
right. And more details. I mean, in the fact about joining the resistance, talk about jumping from the pot into the fire here, the kettle into the fire, that now he's on the ground. Would he would have been pretty much executed on sight.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was not only one, it was dangerous for him to he could have just stayed hunkered down and waited until the U.S. Armies came up through France after D-Day and liberated the area.
Sure.
But he risked his life not only, you know, fighting against the Germans because he could have been killed, you know, during their skirmishes. But as you mentioned, if the Germans captured him, he would have been shot on the spot for being a spy, a terrorist. Or
because I mean, at that point, when he's shot down, at that point, he's an aviator, shot down, prisoner of war. But the
Correct.
Moment he took up the resistance or did anything on the ground, he crossed over to spy and sabotage it. And that
exactly.
changed it. That changed. Even if we assume that the Germans are going to follow all the etiquette and rules of warfare, as a pilot, he should have been, and not only captured, but officers, for the most part, should have been treated half decently as POWs.
Correct.
But they absolutely would have shot him as a spy. Folks, we're talking to Steve Schneider, who is the author of Shot Down. That has a 5-star reader review on Amazon. The book is available on Amazon. I have the links up on our Facebook page and as well as the joemangieshow.com. So go check it out on Amazon. There is a sample of the audiobook on the Amazon site. You can listen to that. You can get it in hard paperback, Kindle, right? It comes in all the forms. It's also
right.
available. I mean, you've got it in some bookstores, right? I thought I saw somewhere in some of the museums and where else do you have the book available? Some stores, right?
Yeah, most of the major air museums have my book, like the World War II Museum down in New Orleans, or the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force, or the Mighty 8th Air Force down in Georgia.
What about Wright-Patterson?
Any bookstore can order the book. Yeah, Wright-Patterson.
Right,
is there any bookstore, if they don't have it in the stock, can order it through their book wholesale distributor.
What was... go ahead.
Most people get the book on Amazon.
Fantastic. So, folks, go check it out, Shot Down. Let me ask you, so back at home, what did your mom know and when did she know it? Was she notified that he went missing in action? And, you know, did they keep that from her for a while? What happened back on the home front, Steve?
Well, that was really tough on my mom. Not only did she have... 1-year-old Susan Ruth, but my other sister was born when my dad was missing in action, Nancy. So she had a 1-year-old and an infant baby girl. And they were shot down on February 8th, like you said, and she received a telegram from the War Department on February 23rd stating that the plane had been hit and the entire crew was missing in action. And she... didn't know anything else until my dad got back to England 8 months later and then sent her a telegram. So that was a really tough time for her and really all the members of the family members of the crew. True. There's lots of excerpts from letters from crew members and family members that make it real personal. They exchanged a lot of letters, mothers, wives, sweethearts, why all these guys are missing in action, you know, not knowing if they'd ever see them again. And, you know, five of the crew came back home, but five of them did not.
Mm-hmm.
So that was tough. Yeah, when my dad got back to England, he said, sent a telegram to my mother saying he was fit as a fiddle and to bank the money, honey, because he had all that back pay from being missing in action.
Well, okay, well, we're going to pause on that for a second, because you're saying that when he went missing in action, they held up the pay?
Yeah, yeah.
So your mother, I assume your mother was getting a portion of the pay, obviously, right, for to take care of her family.
Oh, yeah, he would. Yeah, the pay, he was sending the pay back to her back in the Pasadena, California.
Oh my goodness!
But they stopped the pay because he could have, you know, he was missing in action, but he could have been killed. So if he was, so they were.
So your mother pretty much had to go into widow status. I mean, and act as though, I mean, she didn't have any more income, and that had to be incredibly tough. But we got to take a break here for 7:30, Steve. So stick with us. And we'll come back on the other side and we'll talk about this. Folks, we're talking to Steve Schneider, who is the author of the book Shot Down, a fantastic book, about his father and the plane he commanded and was shot down February 8th, 1944. It's available on Amazon. Go check it out. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to take a pause for Handling Change here on the Joe Mangiacarti Show.
It's time to talk to you.
All right, folks, welcome back here to the final segment of the Joe Mangiacarti Show on AM 830 WCRN and affiliate WACE AM 730 in the western part of the state. Don't forget, you can join the conversation at 508-871-7000. Lines are open and available, and our text line is 617-297-8388. And online with me is Steve Schneider, who is the author of the book Shot Down, which is a fantastic story about his father's plane in World War II. The Flying Fortress B-17 that was shot down on February 8th of 1944. Steve, again, thank you for joining us so early in the morning. So this, getting back to this, you were saying that he's shot down, he's missing in action. So the protocol is they don't know if he's alive or dead, so they actually treat it as if he's dead without any evidence of that, meaning that the pay stops going to your mom, and she has to deal with that. How did your mother deal with no income, you know, in the middle of a war?
Well, she had a lot of family support, which was very important during those dark days. You know, dad's parents and her parents and, you know, family, they all pitched in.
Good, good.
So, that was a tough 8 months for her.
So when he, refresh my memory, he made it back to England himself.
Yes.
How do you do that? You got to cross the channel. How did he get? I mean, they didn't know he was around till he got back to England, or did he get? What happened? How did he come across the first American forces?
Okay. Well, after he decided to join the French Resistance, it was called the Mackie. The Mackie was made up of small independent ragtag guerrilla groups located all around France. His group had about 20 guys in it. They were led by a French lieutenant who had escaped from a German prisoner of war camp. And they would harass the Germans by disrupting communications, sabotaging railroad lines, assassinating German officers, attacking convoys. So he did that with this group for a while. They were supplied by the British through airdrops, and they got their instructions from the British over the BBC through coded messages. But one day,
it's
word
like a
came
real life
that,
Hogan's Heroes, Steve, right?
I've been in farmhouses where they stayed in France, which is pretty cool. But one day, the word came that there were U.S. troops in a nearby village of Trelon, France. So he walked into the town, into the town square, and went up to an army major, actually was elements of Patton's Third Army, would come up through France after D-Day. And he identified himself, and they interrogated to make sure that he was who he said he was. And then he got a ride on a convoy going to Paris, and then from Paris he got on a C-47 transport and went back to England and then reported to his base. So that's how he ended up hooking up with the U.S. Troops.
Got it. And it was he who notified your mom by telegram and not the government. That you see, mom
right.
just out of the blue gets this telegram. Hey, honey.
Yeah, that.
I'm
that,
alive.
That was a
fit as a fiddle.
Yeah.
Money's on the
yeah.
way.
Yeah. That was September 20th. Well, I forget what day in September off the top of my head, but she eventually got a letter from the Army saying that he was found and he was okay. But, you know, that red tape, and you know, that takes a while.
Sure.
So it was a lot quicker for him to send a Western Union telegram to my mother.
Sure. At this point, when he goes up, introduces himself to the, what you said, Major?
Yeah.
Major. And at this point here, does he know the fate of all the other nine members of his crew?
No. The whole time he was missing in action, he didn't know
anything
about any of his crew.
Right. So when he bailed and landed, Benny wasn't with him? He didn't connect with Benny when they jumped?
No, because they bailed out at different... He was the last one to bail out of the plane. And actually, my dad and the plane came down in Belgium, and the other members of the crew that bailed out came down in France. So it was right at the French-Belgium border.
So he went further into enemy territory when he went down with the plane. And of course...
Well, they were pretty much all in.
That's just further in. But at that point now, the plane goes down, so the Germans are going to see this. Did they see it? Did they go look? I mean, they know that they're going to have pilots.
Oh, yeah.
So they were combing the countryside, right, looking for him and the entire crew.
The three that became prisoners of war, they were captured immediately by the Germans after they came down. When my dad bailed out, he came down in some trees, and his parachute got hung up on the trees, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple of young Belgian men came to his rescue before the Germans got there. They went back to a farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, helped him down the tree. And they told him to stay put because this happened early afternoon, and they thought it was too dangerous to try to move him during the day with these German patrols combing the area looking for these U.S. airmen that had bailed out. So that night they came back and got him, took him to a farmhouse where he stayed one night. And there, as I mentioned, he was moved around from place to place after that. But he didn't know what happened to any of the members of the crew until he got back to England.
I can't even imagine what your father is going through at this point, because I don't think you can relax for a second. At any point, someone could betray him, that he could be stumbled upon by a German patrol. So many things could have gone wrong for your dad at this point.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was really stressful. You know, first of all, his plane's attacked, you know, it's on fire, he's got a bailout. He comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew, can't communicate with the U.S. military. And as you say, he's being helped by complete strangers. At that point, he can't speak the language. You know, they're just something like sign language. He has a little French-English dictionary in his evasion kit. And any one of those people, as you said, could be a collaborator and turn him over to the Germans, to the Gestapo.
Yeah.
And while he was in hiding, there's several instances that are described in the book where he was almost discovered. So that was very stressful.
Oh, my God, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and at this point, all of these strangers who are putting their lives on the line for him at any point could have easily said, to protect the lives of my family, I'm either, you know, best case scenario, not going to help you, worst case scenario, let the Nazis know where you are. And so,
right.
I mean, talk about depending on the kindness of strangers. Was life and death matter here for this guy?
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about you were able to connect with some of the families of the people that helped. I don't, you know, was anyone still alive from those days that you were able to meet?
Well, my first trip to Belgium was in 1994. It was the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium, my dad's plane being shot down. And my wife and I went over, accompanied my parents on that trip. And that's when it became personal for me, because I saw these houses and farms where he stayed, and I was able to meet a couple of his helpers who were still living back then in 94. But they're all gone now. But some of the families, descendants of some of the people that he helped them are still alive, and you know, we've become friends. As I said, I've been over there six times now. The most recent was just for the 75th anniversary this last September.
Okay.
So it's a wonderful relationships that we've developed.
I can imagine. I can imagine. When did the book develop? At what point during all this did you realize, I'm going to write a book about this? I got to put this down. And was this your first foray into authorship?
Yeah, I had no writing background or training at all. My career was in sales and sales management. And I retired in 2009 from the company I worked for 36 years, last 36 years, with Vision Service Plan, VSP. And at that time, I had no intention at all of writing a book. I just wanted to go through all the material my parents had kept from the war years, and they had kept quite a bit. The two most significant items were that diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action, and then all the letters that my dad had written to my mother during the war that she had kept. And reading those letters were absolutely fascinating.
I can imagine.
And I just became fascinated with the story of him and his crew, and it became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe, went on the internet, spending countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I went on a quest to find relatives of all his crew and ask them for, you know, any information, pictures, articles that they could give me. And finally, you know, 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that it had to be told, and people needed to know about it. So I decided to write a book.
Let me ask you, Steve, did anybody from the Air Force or the government, you know, reach out to you or cooperate with you, provide any information for you? How was that assistance, if any, there?
No, not really. Pretty much now everything's been declassified, so it's available. A lot of combat diaries, squadron diaries are available on the internet. But I had a ton of information, and I probably would not have written the book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen, Dr. Paul Delahaye and Jacques Lalot, who were young boys during the war and greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand the atrocities committed against family and friend by the Nazis. And later in life, they became local historians. They interviewed all these Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground about events involving my dad and his crew. And they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that took place that would have been lost forever without their research. So I owe them a huge debt. Dr. Delahaye passed away in 2012, but Jock is still with us, and we're dear friends. And they, as you mentioned, all the pictures in the book, and the print book is over 200 time period photographs, so you can visualize everything you're reading about. And they provided me, and a lot of my, the helpers of the people that hid my dad, sent him pictures after the war that are really amazing photos taken, you know, 75 years ago. So you can see these people and see the places where all these events took place, which makes it the reading much more enjoyable.
So
I probably wouldn't have written the book if it wasn't for them.
Well, that's just fantastic. It's phenomenal. So all of the book itself, I mean, is a great historical document, but all of those pictures that you were able to obtain and so forth, I mean, have you shared them with either archives or a museum or anything? I mean, are they going to be preserved? Because I'd hate to, you know, any of this get lost in time.
Right. Well, I have a lot more articles and pictures that aren't in the book.
Sure.
But at some point, I have to figure out what to do with all these. You know, I've scanned all this stuff. I have thousands of or hundreds and hundreds of pictures and documents relating to my dad, his crew, and the whole story and the other people. It's quite an archive. And if people go on my website, I have a ton of information on the website.
So put that out there. It's steveschneiderauthor.com. Steve.
Right.
Steve. So it's Steveschneider author.com, folks. And it's on our Facebook page, and I'll make sure it's on our website as well, so you guys can easily click over to it. You can also just go to Amazon and just search Shot Down. It comes right up. and order the book if you don't. I suggest everybody do. It's just a fantastic book. Like I said, I've been working through the audio version of it. Eight hours and 25 minutes of audio. And I listen on, but I'm listening on the faster speed in my audio app, Steve. So getting through it. But but folks, it's just a fascinating story, and it just reminds us a little bit, and I think we forget what our soldiers, our American men, servicemen and women went through in World War II, what the world was going through in World War II. I think, and I fear this all the time, doing this kind of show, Steve, and we talk, you know, we're political. We talk about politics. We see, you know, this socialism push coming, and it's so scary that we need to remember history. We're doomed to repeat it. And I just think that, you know, this is something that it should be a read for everybody. You've done a fantastic job. And thank you so much for joining us so early for you on the West Coast. I know you had to get up. Are you going to go back and take a nap now, or are you up for the day?
Well, I'm not sure. We'll see.
We'll see how it goes. I think I sent her in a message. I said, at least, you know, you can go make your wife breakfast this morning, right? And that surprise her, and she'll be happy about that. But again, I want to thank you for joining us. Thank you.